Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon. A little bit delayed in getting back to The Dividing Line, thanks to something called a virus. But we are here and good to be back. I do not believe it was a virus that I caught while traveling. I think it was actually waiting for me when I got home. And my lovely daughter provided it to me right before her high school graduation. But I still made it somehow, barely. And things falling apart in there, Mr. Pierce? That looks pretty silly. Actually, but I'll turn the camera around so people can see how odd you look. But
hey, anyway, when you've got to wear all these different hats,
hey, you're the one that got it. You know? Wanted to be the fancy schmancy man.
Toys, man.
Oh, toys. Anyway, and I think it just was that for some reason, the jet lag this time. Last night was the first night I slept more than 4.5 hours since I got home. I would sleep, and then I'd wake up, and that was it. No more sleep after that, and it just wore me down. And so anyways, we're back now, and other than the travel itself, which this time was really, really not something to write home about, not enjoyable, other than the travel itself, the time in the United Kingdom was wonderful. Had a very interesting time on Revelation TV. One of the things that was interesting about being on Revelation TV was that I had four monitors in front of me, and they have two channels. And for the first half hour, we were on the two channels. And I should have noticed this. I found out about it later. But then halfway through, one of the channels disappeared. In fact, when we got a tape of it, I'm in the middle of a sentence. It just cuts out and says, if you'd like to watch the rest of this program, turn to channel blah, blah, blah. And so that was odd, but then I noticed that what I was seeing on the other channel made me go, because the entire second hour of the program, I'm watching Benny Hinn on the other channel blowing people over and doing his normal shenanigans, and I'm sitting here discussing predestination election, answering all the common questions, phone calls, emails, all the common objections, the whole nine yards. And I'm looking down, seeing Benny Hinn on the monitor. It was just a very strange conjunction of having Benny Hinn down there, and then I'm likewise at the same time attempting to discuss, 2 Peter 3:9 or something like that. It was interesting experience. No two ways about it. But getting there was fun, too, because we had to go through the middle of London. Now, remember, I get there. I don't have any luggage. I lost my luggage. Didn't get my luggage for 2 days. So we have to go to Tesco, and Brother Roger takes this. And of course, going over, we had two-year-olds in the row right in front of me, one of whom had an earache. So no sleep, zero sleep, not a bit of sleep all the way to the United Kingdom. So I'm zoning. I was at the airport forever because you have to fill out the lost luggage stuff and all that kind of thing. And so we go to Tesco, we buy a shirt and other necessities, shall we say. And then to get there, you got to go all the way through the middle of London. We didn't want to go on the M25, which is the outer circle thing, because it's a parking lot at that time of day. So we have to go through London. And everybody over there has sat-nav, satellite navigation, you know, TomTom, you know, that type of thing. And every car I passed had it in it, because given the way London's laid out, that would make sense. I'd love to have sat-nav. I mean, I'm a really gadget geek type guy. I live in Phoenix. Who in the world needs satellite navigation in Phoenix? This place is laid out as a grid. You can't get lost here. So it would be totally worthless. But in London, it was great. And he had three different voices that he could put it on. He could put Mr. T, turn right here, fool. And then he had Yoda. And then you had John Cleese of the Monty Python fame. Now, that one was funny. That was hilarious. I couldn't help but sit there and think, how long did that man sit in a studio recording every possible thing you could ever need to say? Especially, realize, you're in London. You're going through all these roundabouts. And these roundabouts can have 3, 4, 5 different exits on these one roundabouts. So there's all these things that this thing has to be able to say that he had to record. It was really hilarious. And he hit the button once where he gave an introduction to himself. And he said, and thank you very much for choosing me because I really needed the money. And it was really good. Oh, by the way, when are we going to do our Scottish dividing line? Because we didn't get a chance to do that. So I brought my accent with me. And
Maybe next time, dude.
I was going to say we'd probably all of a sudden have an instant equipment failure in the other room. Yeah. I did. It was funny, though, because once I got, you know, finished TV stuff and flew up to Edinburgh, and then I ministered at Larbert Baptist Church in Larbert, which is in Falkirk, which is between Edinburgh and Glasgow. And the pastor, Ken Blakely, is Irish. His whole family is Irish. And so I learned to use the term "we" a lot. Would you like a wee little cup of whatever? A wee little cup of milk, or a wee little cup of coffee, or whatever. And it was just constantly "we this," and it was very funny. But anyway, we had a good time there in Larbert, and then in Glasgow. And I actually went into Glasgow twice on my own, which, you know, little old ladies can do. But hey, I did. On my own, and it was, you can walk everywhere if you need to. It's not like Phoenix, believe you me. Not 98 degrees or anything like that outside, but it was enjoyable. But the trip back was, I don't want to talk about the trip back. So anyhow, we are home and we are back, and the next big thing on the public listing is the cruise in June. Some of you are going, cruise in June? Your cruise is in October. Yes, our cruise is in October, but we're doing a cruise in June where I'm going to be speaking. I've been asked, along with R.C. Sproul, to speak on D. James Kennedy's cruise. And so we're going to be doing that in just a matter of weeks. And so toward the end of June, there's going to be a dividing line blank spot in the archives as well. Because I suppose it's possible. I've been told this ship is just totally geeked out. And so, you know, I suppose it's possible, but it would be exceptionally expensive, I'm sure, to the dividing line from out where we're going to be in the Pacific. So anyway, somebody in channel just said they'd tune in for a 2 a.m. Scottish dividing line. Well, thank you. Thank you ever so much. That's very, very kind of you. Just the support I get, you know, from all my friends and people who love me. It's great. But anyway, 877-753-3341 is the phone number. I have Shabir Ali all queued up and ready to go and take your phone calls as well. And it's only a little after midnight in London right now. So, you know, I don't know why we don't have so many. Well, you know, we do have our one London caller, and he has said that he's up at midnight, 1 a.m. in the morning to call in. So maybe some more of my friends from up there in Larbert will call in. Maybe some of those gentlemen who joined me in wearing their kilts, they'll call in and they'll demonstrate that it didn't hurt my preaching at all, that it all went just fine. You're looking somewhat skeptical, Mr. Pierce. In fact, you're looking like you want me to go with the first caller. Yes, indeed. Put them on the air. Stop talking about that stuff or you'll...
Moving right along.
Hey, hello. Yes, indeed. That's okay. All righty. Let's go ahead and take our first phone caller. Let's talk with Aaron. Hi, Aaron. How you doing?
Good, Dr. White. Thanks for taking my call.
It's my pleasure.
And welcome back to the States.
It's good.
I'm jealous of you.
I gotta admit, getting a chance to wander... aimlessly through John Knox's house on High Street in Edinburgh, and to press all the buttons and listen to the dialogues they have recorded and all sorts of fun stuff like that is quite enjoyable. There's no two ways about it.
It is. I've been there, and I would love to go back, so glad to have you back. I just had a question for you. I'm a a lay servant of Jesus Christ, and I serve as an elder at my church, and don't have any seminary training, but have done a lot of self-study, and over the last several years have really felt drawn to doing some formal study, particularly in apologetics, mainly just for, you know, strengthening my own ministry at my local church.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'm here in Central California, and as I'm, you know, looking at balancing the demands of a graduate program with my current career and family and whatnot, I'm looking at some different options from some different universities. And as I'm looking at these, my question really has to do with I'm very reformed in my theology and my soteriology, and I've been looking at different apologetic methods,
mm-hmm.
or approaches. As I sort of started on this, it was mainly an evidentialist type of approach that I was exposed to. But the more I've studied, I really see how a presuppositional dovetails very nicely,
mm-hmm.
with a kind of Reformed theology. I'm just wondering, as I'm looking at schools and looking at programs, in your opinion, how important is it to go through a program that is explicitly and overtly Reformed, in the field of apologetics?
Yeah.
Does it make much of a difference, do you think, or?
Well, obviously it makes a very large difference as to what subjects are going to be covered and how they're going to be covered. I did not have that option myself as far as seminaries that were available to me when you're especially as I was very young and don't have basically any money at all, and you already have a family and children, you make do with what's available to you. And the irony was that the only thing at the time in Phoenix, Arizona, was Fuller Theological Seminary's extension. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I took apologetics, there was only one class I could take. But when I took the apologetics class in the Fuller Extension, it was taught by a Presbyterian from Southern California, and some of the books we had to read included the Pensée by Pascal and Schaeffer's works and things like that. And I remember that I too, as far as, you know, at that time, all I knew was you go to the bookstore, you pick up some books on apologetics, and it's going to be folks like Norman Geisler spouting Aquinas and things like that, and that's just all you've really run into. Especially at that time, there wasn't, you know, Van Til was out there, but no one understood what he was saying, and Bahnsen was just getting ready to, well, Bahnsen had just debated Stein, so. There were some folks that were starting to figure these things out. But anyway, I remember one day this professor, and everybody else was really not enjoying the class. They just weren't getting what he was trying to say. And I remember sitting there one day, and he said something along the lines of, Aquinas proved the wrong God. And I, you know, the only proofs I had ever heard of were the cosmological, teleological, blah, 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 blah. And so I'm, what is he talking about? So I was really trying to tune in on this guy. And the reading assignment, thankfully, really started to put two and two together for me at that time. And that was important in really embracing all of Reformed theology as a whole. So it was that apologetics class that eventually was one of my favorites, because it did illustrate these things. And that was the only one I had that actually came from a presuppositional perspective and had a professor who would be Reformed in his theology. So it was important to be able to study those things. But especially in apologetics, I'm awful glad that I had to sort of get hands-on practice in seminary for apologetics. I mean, I'll never forget in 89 when I was on the air with Robert Funk on a local secular station where the Jesus Seminar had just come out. I had just graduated from college or seminary. The Jesus Seminar, or either that or it was my last semester, one of the two, but the Jesus Seminar had just come out and said Jesus had never said he was returning, so he's not. And I got to be on the air with Funk, and Here I was able to, you know, some of the books I had just read was like Gerhard von Rott's Commentary on Deuteronomy. Now, I mean, that's, if anyone knows commentaries, this is not your conservative commentary, you know, but I had been in a class at Fuller. The professor had stood up. He held his book up. He said, you know what, this is the best English commentary on the book of Deuteronomy. And we had to write reviews of them, and I read this thing, and I read it carefully. I marked it, still in my library today. And we had to write our positives and negatives in our reviews, and the positive was this book has a wonderful binding. And then we moved on to the negatives, and everything was negative. Now, I got a 98 on the review because I had clearly read it, interacted with it, got a high score in the class. You could do that back then. I'm not sure that you could do that today in that particular context, but here I am on the air with Robert Funk, and this is the stuff I've been reading, you know? I mean, I'm very familiar with where these people are coming from. I've been exposed to it. And so it helped me in that way. It wasn't necessarily enjoyable in any way to go through that. I had a friend who went through a couple years after I did in the same stuff, and I remember him coming by my house and almost in tears at the mockery of sound Orthodox teaching that had just taken place in some of the classes. But in essence, what I'm saying is seminary is what you make of it, and it would be wonderful and great to sit around with everybody who agrees with you and hear the angels singing, but it's not necessary to actually getting a good education. I mean, there are some places that are so compromised you can't even start to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those places, they will not really even allow you to say what you need to say and to think what you need to think and to question the things you need to question. But if you can, you know, the other thing I would say, though, especially given where you are, and I don't want to be overly specific here because I don't want to start too many wars, but my other experience basically is that while presuppositionalists and Reformed folks are fully aware of evidentialist argumentation and study it and the whole nine yards, it's not true in reverse. I rarely find evidentialists who even give the time of day to presuppositionalism. They just dismiss it as fideism and just say, that's silly. No one can argue that way. And so you rarely get much of an in-depth discussion from that perspective. And as a result, not only is your viewpoint of presuppositionalism skewed as far as the presentation from them is concerned, but in my experience, and I'm speaking generally here, but in my experience, the treatment that many of those who are non-reformed give of evidential of apologetic issues can be rather surface level, and I think there is a fundamental difference in how you're going to do apologetics and do it as it is in debate. If you come from an Arminian perspective or if you come from a Reformed perspective, it does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a difference as the methodologies you adopt, even to the form of argumentation you're going to use. An Arminian is going to be significantly more tempted to utilize arguments that are going to woo the emotions of the individual than I am, because I'm trusting in something other than that person's free will to bring about their conversion or their acceptance of the truth. And in fact, it's really not up to me to bring that about. I am to remonstrate with them. I am to dialogue with them. I am to attempt to reason with them. But I am never, ever, ever, ever supposed to abandon the truth and to compromise the truth in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, from the Arminian perspective, they're willing to utilize argumentation that is not as strong because the ultimate goal is, well, but I've seen it work. And
yeah,
there's a pragmatism to it that just very, very much concerns me.
Mm-hmm.
As to its long-term impact. And so given that from my perspective, apologetics is nothing more than the external presentation of your theology. It's your systematic theology. Well, that means what your theology is must determine what your apologetics is. If your apologetics is the same no matter what your theology is, then there's obviously a disconnect someplace and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a problem. And so if you're going to a place that is not explicitly reformed, then the apologetic information, you can do it, but just be prepared for the fact that you're going to be in a war stance, in a battle stance, pretty much all the time, not only against those outside, but sadly within as well. And if you're built for that, then great. Most people are not built for that. And, you know, there's a lot of folks. I know John MacArthur has said seminary should never be a place of warfare or a battleground. It should be a place of nurturing and instruction. And that would be wonderful if there were enough seminaries around that could actually do things like that. But that's not been my experience. And my experience was it had to be a battleground for me. And that battleground was very, very important for me in the formation of who I am and what I've done since then.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I don't know if you're at liberty to give much comment on this, but the program that, from a practical standpoint, is looking best for me where I'm at right now, is the MA in Apologetics from Biola, which has a kind of half distance, half summer residency, kind of program,
mm-hmm.
Which looks very feasible. I know people who have gone through that program. I have some friends that have done that, that I think very highly of, and some of the faculty. But I'm just not sure what kind of. I haven't talked to them a whole lot, and I've been kind of holding off on that just to kind of decide on, you know, from my perspective, do I really want to compromise on these issues and go to a place where I might be instructed very well in an apologetic that doesn't line up with my theology.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. I debated Shabir Ali at Biola, and the folks there were very nice to me. But I don't want to go into too much detail, but let's just put it this way. There is a clear contrast between how I did that debate and how that debate would have been done by someone at Biola. A clear contrast. And now I would argue the students probably like that contrast, but that's a different issue. There were some complaints about how straightforward I was. There's sort of a Southern California laid back thing, you know, going on sometimes around there. And there's no. Someone asked me afterwards in the mob of people that were talking with me for quite some time after the debate. They said, "So, what other debates would you like to do here?" They were real excited. It had gone really well, and they wanted to have more debates. And so, who else would you like to debate around here? I couldn't help but say, "Well, to be perfectly honest with you, logically, the closest person around here that would make a good debate for me would be one of your own staff members, William Lane Craig, not just on apologetic methodology, but theology itself, and his Molinism and middle knowledge, and you know all the rest of that stuff." So, I have criticized William Lane Craig's apologetics many times and will have to continue doing so because, again, apologetics is nothing more than the consistent extension of your own systematic theology. And the Molinist position is not a sound systematic theology. It cannot provide a meaningful exegetical foundation of its assertions, and therefore it's going to be inconsistent. And as I have played Craig's debates with Shabir Ali, I've had to at times say, man, you know, Ali has him there because he's wrong. His apologetic is in error at that point. And I certainly take a whole lot of heat for that. And I'm certain that you would take just as much if you were to have to say anything similar to that within the context of Biola itself. So I don't know how that is handled, to be honest with you. I don't know. I do know of some Reformed students at Biola, but mm-hmm. they are in the minority. They are not in the majority. Interestingly enough, what I've been told, there are some Reformed folks in the theology area at Biola, but not in the mm-hmm. apologetics area. And which, again, I find odd because I see the two as heads and tails of the same coin. So it's odd to have that kind of a separation. But, you know, it all depends on whether you can be allowed to, within the context of that kind of a program, produce. See, from my perspective, if you're going to go to seminary, then what you need to do is, while you're there, what you're doing, if you're writing papers, they're going to do nothing more than sit on a professor's shelf someplace, and they're never going to do anything else. You're wasting some really valuable life. Life is short. The older I get, the more I realize that. My daughter just graduated from high school, and I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, I just did this. I remember this with clarity. I just did this. And there she is, you know, at the football field and the whole nine yards. And it's like, this is wrong. That's my youngest child. Life is short. And so what I did in seminary is I made sure that the papers I wrote, and yeah, I was frequently the freak that was asking the professor for more pages so I could do something longer, but I wanted to make sure that if I was going to invest time in really producing something, I wanted it to be something that was going to benefit the church in the long run. I want it to be something I could use in classes I was teaching. I want it to be something I could use in ministry. And so, you know, you go on our website, you read the Trinity Definition of Chalcedon Oneness Theology, this 52-page paper on oneness theology and the doctrine of the Trinity and the history of the Council of Chalcedon and stuff like that. That was a paper in seminary. That was a systematic theology class. I went to the professor. I said, look, you know, I've got this going on. I've got this extended correspondence going on with this prisoner in a Florida prison and with this pastor who's a chaplain there, who's won the theology, and this is what I'd like to do. And he gave me the permission to do it. It's still being used today. So if you can get the freedom to produce materials like that while you're in seminary that's going to be useful down the road, you've got an eye toward what you want to be able to do, ministry in the church, edifying the church, and you're allowed to use the resources. And in fact, in essence, buck the system and disagree with the prevailing perspective, great. If you're basically told, sorry, you can't do that, then, you know, that might, you know, be pretty much determinative as to whether that's something you really want to do or not. Because if you can't utilize the proper resources to produce the kind of material you really want to do, then you might want to, you know, look elsewhere. I know that if you're in the L.A. area, that's one thing. What I would, you know, recommend that you do is there is a tremendous scholar, a man with a huge heart and a great mind over there in Southern California, down in at Westminster Seminary, by the name of Jim Renahan, and he is the professor of historical theology there. Jim heads up the Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies. He's just as bright as they come. He was my partner in debating Crossan and Borg on the resurrection on the cruise couple of years ago. And so I drop him a line. I mean, you can find IRBS online, and I drop him a line and let him know, you know, where you are, what you're doing, and see what his insights are, because, okay, you know, he knows that area better than I do as far as available means of education. So he might be aware of something that would fit your particular parameters better than I can.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for your input. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Aaron.
Okay.
All right. God bless.
Bye-bye.
877-753-3341. We'll take another call here in a few moments, but our break's coming up, so I don't want to... what's that? No. that's how you say no to suggestions made to you from the other room, is you just go, no. And that's how, I mean, that's how the big guys do it. Isn't that how Rush would do it? He would have just said, no, don't want to. So we'll get to Mike up in Wisconsin and your phone calls at 877-753-3341 after we take our break. And I don't like, there we go. We'll be right back.
How the pilgrim's progress is not an easy way. It's a journey to the sun, day by day. Following Jesus is a walk of praise. Oh, it's a pilgrim progress.
What is Dr. Norman Geisler warning the Christian community about in his book Chosen But Free? A new cult? Secularism? False prophecy scenarios? No, Dr. Geisler is sounding the alarm about a system of beliefs commonly called Calvinism. He insists that this belief system is theologically inconsistent, philosophically insufficient, and morally repugnant. In his book, The Potter's Freedom, James White replies to Dr. Geisler, but The Potter's Freedom is much more than just a reply. It is a defense of the very principles upon which the Protestant Reformation was founded. Indeed, it is a defense of the very gospel itself. In a style that both scholars and laymen alike can appreciate, James White masterfully counters the evidence against so-called extreme Calvinism, defines what the Reformed faith actually is, and concludes that the gospel preached by the Reformers is the very one taught in the pages of Scripture. The Potter's Freedom, A Defense of the Reformation and a Rebuttal to Norman Geisler's Chosen But Free. You'll find it in the Reformed Theology section of our bookstore at aomin.org. Public Crimes. The Criminal Mishandling of God's Word may be James White's most provocative book yet. White sets out to examine numerous crimes being committed in pulpits throughout our land every week, as he seeks to leave no stone unturned. Based firmly upon the bedrock of Scripture, one crime after another is laid bare for all to see. The pulpit is to be a place where God speaks from His Word. What has happened to this sacred duty in our day? The charges are as follows. Prostitution using the gospel for financial gain. Pandering to pluralism. Cowardice under fire. Felonious eisegesis. Entertainment without a license. And cross-dressing, ignoring God's ordinance regarding the roles of men and women. Is a pulpit crime occurring in your town? Get Pulpit Crimes in the bookstore at aomin.org. The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture text on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomin.org.
Pulled up a URL from the chat channel during the break there, and it's for Secrets of the Code, now on DVD. If you're not intelligent enough to actually read a book, we'll just read it to you. and, of course, it is narrated by that paragon of all virtue, that scholar of history, literature, and theology, Susan Sarandon. Yeah. Oh my. I'm just looking at it here on the web, and it's there's no end to this foolishness. And by the way, I hope you have noted, I've been trying to sort of tell folks, haven't wanted to, you know, I've actually been a little quiet about it because of, you know, certain criticisms I have received, but the tomb story is not going away, and like so many of these things, there is a body of literature being produced. Tabor and Pellegrino are hard at work, coming up with ways of turning the Acts of Philip into something the Acts of Philip will never ever be. But they're trying, and remember this is how things work. They will produce and produce and produce and write paper after paper after paper. And what happens is people who are non-specialists or people who just don't think clearly, what are they very susceptible to? Well, as long as scholars have written enough books and there's enough verbiage and there's enough tonnage of paper, there must be something to it. There must be something to it. You see it with the Da Vinci Code stuff. You see it with the tomb stuff. The Talpiot Tomb stuff, and it's not going away. They're doing their best to try to, you know, most people have just waved the flag, said, irrelevant. Everyone's given up on it, and even they themselves are going, yeah, boy, well, that's pretty nice that people say that. We certainly haven't, and so anyway, I will keep you apprised of developments. In fact, I think early this morning, Another blog article appeared on that, and keeping up with the Beckwith stuff and trying to provide you with the Mormonism stuff. By the way, I don't think even you're aware of this, Mr. Pierce, but finally have the appendix and stuff for Is the Mormon My Brother in hand, so I should be able to get hold of the folks at Solid Ground fairly quickly and try to get work started on that, because it is very, very much needed.
No, you're going to update that, right?
That's the updated portion. Now, what I did is I put together a bunch of stuff and asked Mike Kwiatkowski to whip it into shape. Because
as I recall, Stephen Robinson was a main target at that time. And
yeah, this has stuff on now.
New guys on
now, and Millett are mentioned in the so it's updated as far as that goes. I mean, I'm not going to rewrite the entire stinking book, because most of it was direct citations from LDS sources anyways. But that's what I've been putting on the look at the chat channel. Mike Kwiatkowski! Different one. Okay, I'm sorry. It's a different one. He does not have only one eye, okay? He doesn't scare children or do comedy routines or any swallow microphones or any of that stuff.
No, we're not turning to Billy Crystal theology. No.
The people in channel would know him better as Tired of New Jersey. That would be the way to remember Mike Kwiatkowski. But anyways, no, we did not take out Mike's appendix. Oh, my goodness. These people have got some real problems. The chat channel is an odd place. Anyway, speaking of Mike's, there is a Mike who has been waiting for 14 minutes and 57 seconds. Let's wait till 15. 59. There we go. All right, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Did you know you were waiting for exactly 15 minutes?
I do now.
You know that now, and
yeah, 15, 43, 44, 45 on my phone.
But that's how long it took Rich to clear your call. But once you're put on hold, then
that was actually pretty quick, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's the man of efficiency. What can we do for you, Mike?
Well, I have a couple things I wanted to ask you about. Well, first of all, today is the last time that I can listen to you until the autumn. Until the fall.
Oh, why is that?
Well, I made an agreement with someone who told me that I need to kind of detach myself from you and your radio show and your website and stuff, because I've been following you for a while, and I talk about you quite a bit when I'm discussing things with people.
Oh, okay.
And so I was advised to go to just kind of get away from you for a while, but I have come in contact with The Narrow Mind, and I'm pretty
Gene
excited
Scott.
About that.
Oh, Gene Cook. I'm sorry.
And I thought that was pretty exciting because I've been listening to him for a while, and he has been telling me that it's okay to listen to rock and roll, hard rock and roll, and gangster rap music, and drink alcohol.
Excuse me.
You don't listen to him.
When he's got someone on that I might find myself debating someday, or have myself debated, I honestly, I'm not much of, I don't actually attend conferences unless I'm speaking at them, and because I'm just too busy. So I have no idea what you're referring to now at all. But anyway, I'm a little more concerned about the detachment thing, just in the sense that it almost makes me sound like, I'm a foot fungus and you have the summer to get rid of it or something.
Well, actually, I agree with you on just, I think, everything that I hear you talking about. And I've been looking really hard to try and find something that I can disagree with you on.
Oh, that's pretty easy. I'm certain we could find something.
Well, I do disagree with you on...
I like the Vikings. How's that?
I'm
now, come on, you can at least come up with something on the Scottish accent. Something.
Oh, yeah, I bet you like the Scottish accent.
I'm sorry, I'm not a click.
You disagree with me on what?
Theopneustos.
Oh, Theopneustos. How can you disagree with me on Theopneustos?
Because you say Theopneustos.
Okay. So you like to spit on people while speaking to them. Is that the idea?
Here,
okay.
Yeah.
Hey, if you want to do that, that's cool. I've just had people threaten to, knife me while talking to them. So I just try not to spit on them at the same time.
There you go. Well, you know, I think they've got plenty of other things that they would like to knife you over at.
Well, this is true. So anyway, so are you asking if you can listen to Gene Cook?
Oh no.
Oh,
I've been listening to him. I do enjoy listening to Gene. He's really great. I really enjoy listening to him.
I've just never heard him do the hard rock thing before.
You just have to listen to his show.
Okay. All right.
But I did have a question because I'm surrounded. I'm going to Bible college right now. I've talked to you before.
Yes.
I don't remember. But I'm surrounded by four pointers. And
I bet you you're not. I'll be perfectly honest with you.
I had a friend of mine call me up earlier, and he was struggling. He was trying to. He's soon to be planning a church. And he was just going over some things that he was just different things on how he's going to do things when he does plant that church, what he needs to stand for and and such and such.
That's good to think about that before you start. Personally, that's a good thing. I commend him for that. No, I'm serious. Many people just run out and assume that that's sort of all a given rather than actually thinking about it before you get started. That's a good thing.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think probably that's right. He's one that would argue with me about the third point, the limited atonement. And that's something that I've actually been struggling with lately myself.
Okay.
And it seems I've listened to your theology and apologetics seminar, and you mentioned that you had some reservations about it earlier on as well. So I've come across some passages that my dad has brought up to me and a couple other people have brought up to me, and I wanted to see what you had to say about them.
Okay.
Such as 2 Peter 2:1. you familiar with that one?
No, never heard of 2 Peter 2:1. or 1 John 2:2 or 1 Timothy 2:4 or 1 Timothy 4:10 or any of those. As soon as you say that and say you've been listening a lot, you've read the extensive, lengthy paper on the website on 2 Peter 2:1.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you had one of those.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I got to say, I've tried to search your webpage or your website for different articles, I've actually typed in, like, 2 Peter 3:9 or 1 Timothy 2:4, 3-5 or whatever, something like that. And they don't come up for me. Maybe I'm doing something wrong.
Well, if you go to the website and you click on apologetics, you're taken to a page that says apologetics helps. And if you click on reformed apologetics, you'll find a number of reformed pages. And the fourth one down says 2 Peter 2:1 and Universal Redemption by Simon Escobedo III. And, it is a very lengthy, treatment of the subject. I actually made reference to it, I believe, yes I did, in The Potter's Freedom, and directed people to that particular URL. I believe there are, 53 footnotes here, and it's, I don't know how many pages it'd be when you print it out, but, that's, you know, if you're looking for an extensive discussion, that's where you're gonna find it, in a brief, recitation. I would point out the same things I pointed out in the debate with Brother Barker many years ago. I'm not sure if you've ever heard that debate, but when you can consider 2 Peter 2:1, a few things to keep in mind. Is the person raising this arguing that a person can or cannot lose their salvation?
No.
If they are, okay, they're not. So what they're saying then is that the false teachers who have been purchased are individuals who were purchased for naught. That is, they somehow have been purchased, but they are not thereby redeemed by that purchasing, or that the sacrifice of Christ does not actually redeem, or something. There's got to be something else added to this purchasing, which they assume is soteriological here rather than any other context, to make it work. A couple things. When the text itself speaks of this act on the part of Christ, every time that this particular term appears in the New Testament, and let's read it from the New American Standard, but false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you, who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. Now, as I said, some take that to mean that since they were purchased, that means they were saved, and therefore the destruction means that there is no eternal security. Those who promote a universal form of atonement, but a non-salvific form, that is, in essence, Christ dies to make salvation possible, but that sacrifice in of itself does not accomplish what is, I'm trying to avoid pointing out real problems of it right at the start, because my initial thought is to say that it does not accomplish what God intended it to, because all this goes back to what did God intend to do in the atonement? What was his intention? If you haven't read, the reading list that I posted on my blog for the class this October would be a wonderful thing for you to look at over the summer yourself, because it includes John Owen's Death of Death, it includes Gary Long's Death and Atonement, and it deals with all of these issues and has links to where you can purchase them and things like that. So.
Okay.
And so don't pick up the phone now. I would recommend that you take a look at that, because that I think would assist. And do you have the Potter's Freedom?
I do, and I loaned it to my Arminian, very vocal, offensive friend.
Okay. Well, the two chapters there, you know, my main concern when we discuss this issue is to ask the question: what was God's intention in the atonement, and what does the atonement accomplish? I do not believe that you can come to a sound understanding of the work of Christ if you do not approach it from the Godward side, because this was a divine act. If we approach it from the human side, as most people do in a pragmatic sense, and saying, well, what's my relationship to the cross? I don't define what God's intentions and purposes were. And if I start from that perspective, I'm going to cause a problem. My interpretation is going to be flawed as a result. And so I try to get folks to go the right direction. So anyway, going back to the text, you still with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Can I say something real quick?
Yeah.
One thing that my dad brought up to me was that when I look at what the rest of the Bible has to say, and I look at the doctrines of grace and the biblical foundation for those, this is what he, limited atonement, he says, is a logical conclusion that he doesn't think that is necessarily supported by Scripture based on texts such as this. He did point out 1 John 2:2,
mm-hmm.
And I've heard your take on that,
mm-hmm.
And I mean, once again, I'm like, I do agree.
Well, but, my question in response would be, okay, I know those texts. I've yet to have one of these individuals, when they raise them, answer my questions from Hebrews 10 and Hebrews 7, Hebrews 8, Hebrews 9, and actually deal with the meaning of what atonement means. Is it propitiatory? Has the wrath of God been satisfied? Where do you get this idea that propitiation can be simply something that's theoretical, but wrath actually isn't satisfied, so that Jesus can die as a propitiatory sacrifice for someone who will then bear the wrath of God? These are the questions I never hear people answering. Instead, they go, well, you know, it sounds like this over here. It sounds like that over there. And I go, wait a minute. 2 Peter 2:1, never is the term bought used soteriologically in the New Testament without the price being mentioned. It's not mentioned here. The term master is not Lord. It's despotes. That's not a soteriological use at all. Why don't people respond to these things? They're assuming meanings to master that aren't in the Greek. They're assuming the certain uses of the terms that just are not consistent with the rest of the New Testament. And these are the traditions that are pushing these things. And I think I can demonstrate these are traditions, because when I go to Hebrews and I start walking through the specific passages that are about the atonement, its scope, its purpose, its intention, its results, they're very, very clear. These texts aren't about that. This text is about false teachers. 1 John is not about the extent of the atonement. And so they're taking a passing reference, expanding that out. And then when you come to the actual text, where you actually have to deal with the assertion of Hebrews. He is able to save to the uttermost. By this will we have been sanctified, perfected, not just hypothetically, not just, well, someday we hope so. So, you know, that's a concern for me. I very, very, very rarely ever had a meaningful conversation with somebody on these particular subjects. In fact, I wish I could have time. I'm, you know, maybe this summer, I don't know, but I've always wanted to get back to the one time I got semi-close to that in a written form in a discussion with Eric Svensson on our blogs. But then he went away and I went away and he sort of got to have the last word, and I've always kept the post because it's always been my intention to go back, because I think it would be very, very useful too. I've always wanted to. It hasn't been a lack of desire on my part. It's just, you know, there's Islam and Roman Catholicism and Mormonism and everything else just keeps, doesn't go away. So I want to get back to those things. But that to me, you know, read Owen's Death of Death. Read some of these works that will focus upon the fulfillment of God's intention, the perfection of the cross. And I just don't find anywhere where these texts are saying, well, Christ died to make it possible for you to be saved. That's not the apostolic proclamation.
I know that you've actually heard the response, but the one that I keep getting is, they do believe that, you know, they don't believe that Christ died just to make someone savable necessarily, but they would say that it's just as if you were given a money order and I paid for it, but you didn't cash it in, so I'm still out the money, but you didn't, you know.
But see, what that completely misses is the intention of the atonement in the sense of the fulfillment of the wrath of God against sin. You see, the problem with that entire analogy is that it takes something like giving of a gift and turns that into the entirety of the relationship to the atonement. That's not what we're talking about. Was the wrath of God satisfied in the place of every single human being in the death of Christ? And was it God's intention that the death of Christ satisfy the wrath of God against every single individual in the exact same way? That's what the universal atonement position is saying, is that there is no distinction, there's no union of the elect based upon God's sovereign freedom with Christ in his death. There is a union of all of humanity. And then what then becomes what makes the decision as to whether that atonement is fulfilled or not becomes either in full-blown Arminianism, well, of course, full-blown Arminianism doesn't even believe in substitutionary atonement, but in quote-unquote one-pointers, whatever you might want to call them, that's man's free will. The four-pointers might want to at least talk about election, but I'll be perfectly honest with you. You find someone who's a four-pointer who doesn't immediately say, oh, by that I mean this, and they start utilizing very specific terminology that would identify them as really knowing what they're talking about. 95% of the quote-unquote four-pointers that I have talked to, their objections against particular redemption were actually objections against unconditional election. That's what they actually were about. They're actually opposed to the idea that God has sovereignly chosen a specific number of the elect, not based upon any foreseen merit of their own, but based solely upon his own purpose and grace, the freedom of his own will. That's what they're actually objecting to, not to the particular redemption part.
I see that also, and I agree.
Yeah, that's well, and so they're not, so the issue really isn't those texts. Because if their objection is actually against unconditional election, well, that debate has to take place someplace else. The whole reason that they're reading 1 John 2:2 or 2 Peter 2:1 the way that they are is because of the fact they don't actually really believe in unconditional election. And I've never found one person who believed in rejected unconditional election to believe in irresistible grace. And so now they've got the middle three are gone. And so if you don't have the middle three, you can't really believe in total depravity because man must have a free will to go save himself. So the first four are gone. If you don't have the first four, there's obviously no reason to believe in the perseverance of the saints. And so the whole thing, you know, comes crumbling down. And that's why folks who run around calling themselves four-pointers, who do not know who Amaro was and cannot exactly tell you what Amaro actually believed. That's Amaraldianism, and that's not actually four-pointism, by the way. Some people think it is, but
that's somebody might somebody, I'll just say somebody told me that just the other day. He brought that up to me.
Yeah, Amaraldianism is not technically four-pointism, okay? Those who actually, now there's different takes, and I think Amaraldians need to be a little bit more honest in their recognition that Emerald was not the easiest person to read, and there are different takes even on his particular understanding, but they make a concerted effort. Let's give the Amaraldians this much credit. They make a concerted effort to continue to believe in unconditional election while taking a different understanding of the relationship of that decree to the sacrifice of Christ. And, you know, I don't have any problem with discussions about the fact that the sacrifice of Christ has impact outside of just the redemption of the elect. There is a cosmic sense in which God's justice is demonstrated in the sacrifice of Christ. There's no question about that. But that's not actually addressing the real issue, which is, what was the intention of God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit in the sacrifice of Christ in reference to the redemption of mankind? Who was united to him in his death? Where is the wrath of God propitiated? Is it propitiated in the death of the Son alone, which I would argue eventually leads rather inevitably to universalism in many forms, or is it that Christ suffers wrath and all unbelievers will likewise suffer wrath for the same sins that allegedly he already atoned for? That's where the issue comes in. I recognize that there are other aspects that we can talk about, but until we get that one down, I'm really not sure that we've addressed the important subject, and certainly important in regards to the perversion of those things by Roman Catholicism and the Mass and all these other things, which is why it's so very important that we really do have a solid understanding of the cross.
By the way, in behalf of my friends, they do very much believe in unconditional election or the biblical support for that, but they just struggle with a particular atonement.
Well, okay, I can understand that there are people who do that. I would likewise then say to them in response to that, okay, if you do, why do you? Because how can there be a consistency between the idea that God has elected a certain people, united with them with Christ, so that his death becomes their death? Why unite to Christ so that his death becomes their death, individuals that are not the recipients of his unmerited favor? Why punish the Son in behalf of an individual who will be rightly judged for their sins so that the sins are punished twice?
I've asked them the same question, actually.
Yeah, I honestly think that one of the best ways to get around or get over the objection, if the objection is actually a biblically grounded objection, is to focus upon the perfection of the work of Christ in the book of Hebrews. I've found the book of Hebrews to be the greatest antidote to that, to be perfectly honest with you. And honestly, to be honest as well, I think it's because the book of Hebrews is so difficult for many people. That's why there's these as many of these discussions we have. Hey, Mike, have a great summer. Look up the reading list for the class. I think you'd find the books there to be very useful. Get the Potter's Freedom back from your Armenian friend, and we'll talk to you in the fall, I guess. All right?
Yeah.
All right.
Good talking to you,
man. All right. God bless. Bye bye. Well, that was an interesting program. Two calls, half an hour apiece. You can't argue that we don't give you enough time. So, not quite a full half hour, about 20 minutes each. But thanks for listening to Dividing Line. Tuesday is going to be in the afternoon, not in the morning. Tuesday will be this same time on Tuesday rather than morning time. So keep that in mind. I'll blog it. We'll see you then. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.